Hi everyone, it's Hillary here with a quick reminder for you. This week, we're going to be rebroadcasting one of our absolute favorite episodes while we're working on our next round of truly inspiring interviews. It's definitely worth a second listen or a first if you missed it the first time around, and we'll be back with new episodes soon. Now, on to the show. I'm Hillary Kerr, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am deeply excited to have a very dear friend on the podcast, the one and only Eva Chen. For those of you who don't know Eva, she's one of the most beloved humans in the fashion industry, and she is incredible at her job, which is leading the fashion partnerships team at Instagram. She's also a new author, and her first incredible children's book, Juno Valentine and the Magical Shoes, is officially in stores now. But before she crossed over to the social world at Instagram and into your local bookstore with Juno Valentine, Eva actually started her career in the old school publishing world as an editor with me at Elle Magazine. I'm so excited to sit down and discuss her amazing career and hear more about her second life and third. Now on Second Life, it's Eva Chen. Okay, Eva, so with this podcast, we always like to start in the beginning because that seems like an appropriate place to begin. What did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
So I went to Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, which is basically like maybe the nerdiest college in the world. And most of the student body there was studying engineering or medicine, even though it has amazing liberal arts as well, like English and all the humanities. So I was pre-med when I started in college.
You thought you were going to be a doctor?
I for sure thought I was going to be a doctor.
What kind of doctor?
I thought I wanted to be a pediatric cardiologist. But clearly, I'm not wearing scrubs right now. I was very inspired by George Clooney in ER, but I ultimately graduated with an English degree.
So how did you make that switch? And at what point did you realize that medicine was perhaps not your direct path?
I mean, for me, I was always pretty decent in the sciences. Like I took all the APs for science and did reasonably well. But then when I got to Hopkins, it was just like so hard. Like I felt like I was struggling really, really hard to get like decent grades, like B pluses. I had to study for like 8 hours a day to like basically understand organic chemistry. And it just felt like I was trying to fit like a square peg into a round hole. That's the saying, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so summer between junior and senior year, I kind of was like, okay, like this is the do or die moment. I have to think about whether I'm going to take the MCAT and go on to medical school or if I'm just going to like try something new and have a fun, quote unquote, summer to just explore what's out there. That spring, I applied to like 20 different internships. Mm-hmm. I had a very, very bad strategy or kind of not fully thought out strategy of just applying to companies I had heard of.
But that is a good strategy in some ways because they must have meant something to you on some level if you recognize them.
I mean, for me, I was like, I'm going to apply to an internship at Random House because when I read some of my favorite books, I see this logo. Okay, I've heard of it. MTV, because this was the day and age of like Cribs and TRL. And I was like, wow, like that would be fun to work there. And I applied to some magazine internships because I always grew up surrounded by fashion magazines. My parents worked like kind of peripherally in the fashion world. And so I was like, okay, I'll apply to a few internships. So I applied to an internship at Harper's Bazaar. And of all the internships I got, it was the only one that paid, which was really exciting. And it was like a fortune at the time. I remember it was like $300 a week.
Whoa.
Oh, my God. My brain like exploded. So I was like, obviously, I'm going to take this one. And that was kind of, I think, the turning point. Really in my life, one of the major turning points in my life, taking that internship, because it set me off on this path that I didn't even know existed.
So what department was your internship in?
I was split between beauty and features. So what was amazing about the beauty department, which we all know is like beauty products galore, the whole area smelled good, like lavender and chamomile and like great glowy skin. And then I was split between features, which was like my other kind of passion point, which was books. It was my job to open all the mailers from all the different book publishing companies, you know, organize all the books by release date and kind of just help keep the book department organized.
Oh, that's like so nerdy heaven.
Oh my gosh, it was amazing. It was very satisfying and kind of hit both sides of my brains equally.
Okay, so you have this amazing internship at Bazaar. You go back to school, and then what do you do after you graduate?
So I had this amazing internship at Bazaar, which was just like my brain felt like it was lit on fire from the first day I walked in. And there was an editor there named Emily Doherty, who played a really big part in my career. I remember my first day I showed up and they were like, this is the beauty closet. It's going to be a big part of your job to keep this organized. And then they opened these like kind of magical doors and it was like the heavens opened up. Angels were singing and there was like a harpist playing in the background.
And for people who don't know, the beauty closet is there are so many beauty products mm-hmm. that are either sent unrequested or are requested and called in by the entire magazine, including the beauty team. And obviously all of those products need a place to live. So they mm-hmm. all go into this like beautiful, magical closet.
Yes.
Of
it is a closet of beauty.
It's a treasure trove.
Literally. So you would like open this door. And then I organized all the products by category. It was like I basically built out my own Sephora/Ulta. And so I had a skincare section, a hair care section, a hair serum section. Everything was just super organized. Makeup I organized by category, like eyeshadow, eyeliner, et cetera. And I am half Virgo, half Libra. So like that organizational stuff really appealed to me. And I would say like that internship was really interesting because I learned my bosses would drop clues like not on purpose, but they would be like, oh, we haven't gotten around to doing X, Y, and Z. And that summer as an intern, I was like, I don't get why someone hasn't done this yet. And I would just do it. And I would say that was one of the main lessons I learned that summer and just in life is like, if there's something that someone else doesn't want to do, like one way to stand out, because I get asked that question a lot on informational interviews. People are like, how do I stand out? I'm like, do the things no one else wants to do. Make yourself useful. Don't just wait to be asked to do something.
Like, Take initiative.
Just do it. But I think that summer really just kind of lit my brain on fire. And it made me realize that there are a lot of careers out there that you might not know about. And you have to like find ways to learn about all these different paths because you never know which one will be right for you.
So did you start in magazines then right after you graduated?
No, because so when I graduated, I was ready. I was like very motivated. I was like, watch out, magazine world. Here I come. And it was really the beginning. It was the first dot-com boom. And a lot of magazines were shutting down and kind of going through transitions in their business. And I could not for the life of me find a job in magazines. So I did what many, I think, enterprising young people do. And I said, I'm going to go to law school, which so I basically worked at a law firm for 9 months, a law firm called Cravath, Swain & Moore. I was a paralegal, basically, or they called them like legal assistants. And it was actually a really good experience because I learned without a doubt that I don't want to be a lawyer. And that's what I say. That's the other thing I say over and over again to young people who are like, oh, like, what should I do with my life? I'm like, try things. If you don't like them, like,
then
you know. Don't feel bad about it. Don't feel like it's a failure. Don't feel like it was a quote unquote waste of time. Because if you imagine a big whiteboard filled with every job in the world from like astronomer to zoologist, if you try it, you can cross it out if you don't like it. And it just helps you get one X closer to what the actual thing it is that you like. So I worked at the law firm. I knew pretty quickly it wasn't for me. I worked there for 9 months. And that whole 9 months, I was basically looking for another job.
So you were searching for a magazine job or a book job?
A magazine job. I was like maniacally searching for jobs. So I turned over every stone. I think people have to be quite entrepreneurial when they're looking for jobs. So don't just apply to jobs that you see listed on the website. Contact your alumni office. If you went to high school and someone from your high school went on to work at a magazine or whatever company it is that you like, reach out to them. Put in your subject line in big letters. Class of 1990, blah, blah, blah. Please help. Like, need your advice. And ask for informational interviews. I remember when I was looking for a job, Tawny Goodman, who was then the style director of Vogue, she went to my high school. So I reached out to her and was like, please, I need advice. And she graciously took like 20 minutes out of her time. And she's an incredibly busy woman to speak to me. And I still remember that with a lot of gratitude.
So eventually you got a job at Elle because that's where we met.
Yes.
So how did that happen?
So I first got a job at Lucky in the fashion closet. I was doing credits with an editor named Joanna May. Lucky had just started then. And it was like a startup basically within Condé Nast, but it was doing incredibly well. So they needed someone to be a freelancer, literally to like when you read a magazine and it says top, Who What Wear collection at Target. $78, you know, comma.
Everything is under 50.
Okay. Squeeze me. $48, comma, Target stores, select Target stores nationwide. There is someone whose job it is literally to check that.
That was yours?
And that was my job. But again, it appealed to my weird organizational obsession.
And also probably like the paralegal stuff.
Yeah. So I worked there. She had reached out to Emily Doherty and was like, hey, I remember like you had an intern last summer and she seemed like really on top of things. I need someone to help me. And Emily had forwarded that to me and I reached out to her and I got hired pretty much immediately because, again, Lucky was so crazy and so busy. And then just a few weeks later, Emily was like, we think we're going to have a beauty assistant opening up soon. Like, are you interested? You're freelance at Lucky. So are you interested in a full-time job? And obviously, everyone wants a full-time job.
Duh.
Benefits, the ability to go and get a flu shot is really fantastic.
Yep.
So, and that's kind of how it came about. And I'd kept in touch with the people I interned for and the people I created connections with. And that's something I think that a lot of people actually don't do. A lot of people will meet with someone and then like disappear. Mm. I have done this thing ever since I worked at Teen Vogue, where I usually meet with one college student or like young person starting out in their career once a week. So like literally for the last 10 years, I've met with like one college student or one young person a week. And so I've met with like hundreds mm-hmm. of people. And I can count on two hands the number of people who've kept in touch with me.
So cut to Emily hires you
yes.
at Elle, which is where we met.
Yes.
And you were so kind to me. You started mm-hmm. not so long before I did, but right. you had been there for a minute. You taught me expenses. You told me that there was such a thing as a Chanel sample sale. Mm. You were a really good friend, and you were also really busy all the time. You were constantly writing things. And one thing that I think that people don't necessarily always understand about beauty writing is that there's so much science mm-hmm. involved in that writing. But what did you like about being in the beauty department, and what did you not like?
I loved being in the beauty department. I feel like the beauty personalities generally are a little bit more approachable and a little bit more democratic, let's say, than the fashion peers, just because beauty ultimately is about making someone feel good, feeling good in the skin they're in. And it's a universal thing, regardless of size, color, you know, weight, where you're from. Like, everyone wants glowy skin. Everyone wants nice hair, like whatever texture your hair might be. And so I really nerded out over being in the beauty department, just because that kind of tangible feeling of helping people feel good was very, very satisfying. And then also, I think because I always liked science and pre-med, and I always loved reading, like, I don't know if it's still around, there's a magazine called Prevention Magazine, which is literally for like the AARP generation. It is for like a mom. I started subscribing to that magazine when I was like 15 years old, because I liked reading the studies. I liked learning that broccoli has a lot of vitamin K or whatever, yeah. and like kind of applying that to my own life. Those kind of aspects of health and wellness, which are like so trendy right now, like I've always been super into. So that probably was the best part of working in the beauty department. It's just I met amazing people. It's where I met like people I consider friends now, like Pat McGrath. And the worst part of working in beauty, I guess there are like only so many words you can use to describe like red lipstick. Think about it. Like, how do you describe red lips over and over again for like 8 years? Crimson pout. Like magenta smile. Like, it's hard to reinvent the beauty wheel. And you see that beauty is very cyclical. So it goes from like boho kind of like to really polished. There's always like a Margot Tenenbaum like reference thrown in there. Like, it just comes around in cycles, which is good. The barrettes that you bought when you were in seventh grade, guess
what?
Hold
on to them.
They will make a comeback.
I also remember you were very experimental too. Like, do you remember when you got a perm?
Yeah, I had multiple perms. I had a mullet. I was reminiscing with my hairstylist, Damien, a few weeks ago, because I'm like, should I grow my hair out long and then cut it really short again? And he was like, remember you did that like 15 times? Like,
So you were Elle for a while.
3 years, yeah.
And then you got promoted a bunch while we were there. Yeah. I remember feeling very proud of you.
Aww.
And then you left and went to Teen Vogue.
Yes.
And you were the beauty director there
yes.
for like 7 years.
Yes.
What was that like? And was that your first real experience like hiring long term?
Yeah, actually it was. I never really kind of thought that much of it, because I think from like my nerdy experiences in student council and like managing that kind of organization, that also helped. But Teen Vogue was an amazing experience. Like, I have always loved teen and youth culture. I was a very late bloomer in life, just in general. I was always like, it felt like years behind my peers. And so the teen years, I feel like a big affinity towards teenagers because I just want to kind of have a giant hug and like sweep all teenagers under my arms and just like protect them for a few years. So at Teen Vogue, I did beauty and health. And so I got to exercise both parts of my brain again. So I would literally write articles about like the crystal meth crisis or opioid addiction on one side, or eating disorders on like with half my brain. And then the other brain I'd be reporting on like Leighton Meester skincare routine. So it was really fun. And then I had an assistant and I had an associate editor. And I just, in general, when I hire, I try to hire the people that I like genuinely like and want to like spend like 9 hours, 9 to 12 hours a day with.
What do you look for in a resume?
You know, when I look at a resume, I don't really look at where someone went to college. That doesn't really matter to me. I feel like I'm looking for someone that clearly took initiative and seems on top of it. And I actually feel like more than a resume, I get a lot more from an interview than a resume. So it's like, if your resume is good and you've had great positions, great, it'll get you in through the door. However, it's like, it's the interview that'll really like lock it in.
Because it's true, you do spend so much time with the people you work with. You need to have the right sort of culture fit and personality fit.
Yeah, exactly. For sure. And I want someone like, I guess I'm looking for someone like similarly who seems to have a lot of initiative, will do things without being asked.
Has an entrepreneurial attitude.
Exactly. And like kind of looking at things in a different way. And you don't want your job to feel like a job. You want it to feel like exciting and something that you're
passionate about.
I feel like very fortunate in that, like in my career, I've always been at jobs that felt more like kind of passion projects. And the moment it stopped feeling like a passion project is kind of when you know that it's time to move on and you might have outgrown it.
Well, speaking of moving on, after Teen Vogue, you became the editor-in-chief of Lucky.
Yes, but there was a break in between. I left Teen Vogue after 7 years. I had worked there a really long time. I learned so much from Amy Astley and the whole team there. And Tom, my husband, was working on a project. I think it was either for Hulu or Vivo. I don't remember which one because they both have like 4 letters in all caps. So he was working on a project for one of those out in LA for 6 months and he was filming. And so he was like, hey, like, we have this cool opportunity. We can try somewhere new. And, you know, we didn't have kids at the time. I was like, why not? Like, why not move to the West Coast? So we rented this little bungalow in Venice. That was an amazing time because I was still doing some work for Teen Vogue. I was on contract and I was doing some consulting with a few startups. And then Anna Wintour reached out and was like, we need someone to help out with Lucky. It's going through a transition and, you know, process. And it was right when Anna was coming on as the editorial director of Condé Nast. And so I started consulting and freelancing at Lucky. And yeah, she asked me to come on and take on the editor-in-chief role. And it was kind of like really wild and crazy to me. Yeah, it still kind of is, actually.
Well, I remember when that happened, we were all so excited for you. You were the first editor of our generation to take on one of those big editor-in-chief roles. It was a really exciting moment, but I also remember feeling, I think I saw you not long after that, and you were telling me you're like the first week, I literally would come home and just pass out. I was so tired. It was so exhausting. So what was that like stepping into a huge role, bigger than anything that you had done before, and also knowing that you were going to have to make some changes?
It was extremely stressful, but also exhilarating, the opportunity to kind of reshape a magazine in a way that I felt my peers would enjoy. So like from the outset, I knew that I wanted to bring on like a digital feeling to it, feature influencers. This was, you know,
you put influencers on the cover.
Yeah, I put Chiara Ferragni on the cover like six and a half years ago. I knew that that's where so many people got their inspiration. I look at like Who What Wear, for instance, and like I've learned about so many influencers through Who What Wear. I learned a lot about style and dressing from Who What Wear. And I really saw that that's where a lot of people from our generation were taking inspiration from. So it was really overwhelming. I mean, I felt very fortunate in that like if you had to choose like a patroness for magazine publishing, to have Anna Wintour kind of help you and guide you through the process was pretty much as fortunate as one can get.
What's the best thing that you learned from working with her?
I mean, she is just a brilliant businesswoman. She's incredibly forward-thinking. She's very decisive. She's just like the most efficient person. She makes me feel like a slacker and like inefficient. And I mean, I showed up 24 minutes early this morning. Probably that is like a byproduct of working with her, where it's like I always try to be like slightly early because I'm like petrified of being late. I think that was drummed into me from working with her.
Yeah. So what kind of manager were you? Because this is also, you went from managing people, but smaller, mm-hmm. a smaller team, to having an entire magazine.
So one thing that I think people don't realize about the editor-in-chief role is that it's much less creative, and it's basically like a management position. Basically, the thing I learned about management is that you have to hire people whose vision you trust and who have the right kind of spirit and soul. And I hired people who I felt like just had that sense of humor and that point of view. And you don't want to manage like – you don't want to have like 50 direct reports. I think that's the main thing about management that I learned, is that, you know, 10 max. You don't want more people than that reporting to you, because then you become basically like
it's just meetings.
It's just meetings, and that's basically pure administration, and there's no creativity to it. So that I feel like was a really important kind of learning process for me.
How much of the business side did you have to deal with, get to deal with, want to deal with?
I think that's one of the main. I mean, I hate to use the word regret, because I generally have like very few regrets in life, but I feel like that's one of the key learnings, is that I should have been more involved from the business side from the beginning.
I feel like it used to be very church and state, where you weren't even allowed to be.
Exactly. Like I think when we were interns together, it was completely church and state. So there was like a business side that took care of everything business related, and editors were purely journalistic kind of, and did not kind of go over to that side, especially at that kind of turning point for Lucky. I feel like I should have kind of immersed myself in that more and learned more about like P&Ls and like debt loads. But at that point, I was just kind of so immersed in just getting things organized and sorted on the editorial side that it was hard to kind of imagine taking on that extra aspect. Because I literally, like when I started at Lucky, was working, I think, about 18-hour days, no exaggeration. Like literally I would get in, and then by the time I got home at 7, I probably would do like 4 or 5 more hours of work and then like pass out.
I mean, that's not sustainable.
It was not sustainable, but like kind of necessary in the beginning.
At what point did you realize this is winding down for me and I need to start looking for my next thing?
So Lucky went through a transition where Condé Nast kind of merged it with a startup called Beachmint, and it was meant to be kind of an experiment in social commerce and kind of content meets commerce. And for me, it was just like, it was a really challenging time in my life, because first I was pregnant, and going through pregnancy, which you have been through and you know, I just felt my brain was like scattered in a million different places. And I was trying to learn the whole digital e-commerce aspect of the business. And, you know, the magazine had to like, we knew it had to have changes such as like reducing frequency, reducing staff, et cetera. But it was like really hard. It was super crazy hard to do that while basically, I remember I had given birth to Ren, my first child, in like mid-December. And then I took like 3 days off, and then I had to come back and like lay off a whole bunch of people at Lucky. I'm not talking about like random people, like laying off people who I'd grown close to as friends. And that's where I look back and I think like, it maybe if I had been more involved on the business side of things and understood the kind of financial aspects of the job better, I would have seen the fact that I would have had to do that a little bit earlier. But it was not something I did lightly. I knew that I was affecting families and people who I greatly respected. And so I resigned in April. So that was like 3 months later. And then I just basically was like, I want to take a few months off. A friend of mine who I'd met a few times, I met him at South by Southwest, and I had met the whole team at Instagram, you know, several times, including Kevin Systrom, the founder. And it was, I think, in May, 1 month later, after I had left Lucky, and I was like kind of just chilling out and hanging and like cooing in Ren's face, who was 4 months old at the time. And
giving yourself some maternity leave.
Yeah,
which you hadn't been able
maternity leave is great. I think it's really important to take it. I mean, you need that time both physically, emotionally, and mentally. And so I was taking that time, and then Charles reached out to me and was like, hey, I'm in
Charles Porch.
Charles Porch.
So lovely.
Shout out to Charles Porch. So he had reached out to me and was like, hey, I'm in New York for like X, Y, and Z thing. Like, let's hang out. And I was like, sure. Like, mom needs a night out. And we went to like ABC Cochina. And he was like, hey, so we have this position, and like, it basically is like, for you. And I was like, oh.
So like they created it for you?
No, I mean like there wasn't.
But it hadn't existed.
It hadn't existed. They would have needed it anyway.
And that position was?
Director of fashion partnerships for Instagram.
And what exactly did they explain that to you as encompassing?
Basically, I would be the liaison between the fashion community and the larger team at Instagram. You know, Instagram was at the time about 5 years old, so it wasn't like a brand new platform.
But one that you had used from the jump, I feel like you were always super active on it and amazing in the way that you engage with social media in general, but Instagram in particular. And so the idea would be that you would go and speak to people in the fashion world and make them understand the importance and value and application of Instagram?
Yeah, basically, like, the thing is with Instagram is that everyone in the fashion community, like, loved it from day one because it was very easy to understand from a fashion perspective.
And it's aesthetics.
And hashtag aesthetic. Because basically, like, you think about the fashion world and it's one that where editorial is the most important thing. So, like, the visual image, like a photograph, that translated so well for the fashion community. And they knew how to use it from day one. They saw its purpose. And some of the fastest growing accounts at the time were fashion. And so you had these brands, whether it was like Balmain and Olivier or like Marc Jacobs, two upstart brands, really kind of doing magical things on Instagram. And so I suppose Instagram just saw the need to have someone just like be there for them and offer support as needed. So I work with like now it's like if models, designers, stylists like you, Hillary Kerr, anyone
you've never
who needs
invited
it,
me in.
Oh, my God. You don't need an invitation. The door is open for you at all times.
I want to come to the tiny conference room with you.
Come. We're building a new one because it's like the old one got so much foot traffic. We'll put it that way. People, there's a lot of demand for that mini conference room. So we're building a new one on the Instagram floor. You have an open invite. So, yeah, I've been there now for 3 years. I love it.
What's the craziest thing that you've done?
Craziest thing
or like
that
a real
done.
Pinch me moment at Instagram.
I suppose like when icons like Victoria Beckham or Donatella Versace say they want to visit the mini conference room, you're like, you are Donatella Versace. Like when she came, she redid the conference room into like hashtag like Versace gold. Like everything was Versace. It's no longer like that, but that's one of the reasons why we have to refurbish it because so many people, like while it was Versace-ified, like so many people wanted to come in and take photos and do videos and whatnot.
So what does your day-to-day look like?
Well, it's the same as you. Like I feel like I realize that the kind of job that I like doesn't have like a specific day to day. It has like structure, of course, like recurring themes. But there are some days like I just flew back from London yesterday afternoon. So I travel for some of the fashion weeks. Some days I'm, you know, sitting in front of a computer and like staring at emails and trying to get down to inbox zero, which is my goal in life, which I have to just accept. Inbox zero is not going to happen.
It's a myth.
And then other days I like look around and I'm like, I cannot believe that I am at X, Y, and Z venue. And I feel so fortunate because the people who work at Instagram are so like passionate and smart. They're genuinely like invested in making Instagram the best place for whether it's an athlete, whether you're a poet, whether you're a kindergarten school teacher, whatever you do, making it a friendly place for you. And we actually just announced 2 days ago, like all these new shopping tools that we're launching. And like, I think 90 million people have used the Instagram shopping tag. So there's like a lot that's coming as well.
That's exciting.
It's exciting.
So something else that's exciting is you also just wrote your first book.
Yes.
Juno Valentine.
Yes.
So, and the magical shoes.
And the magical shoes. You can't forget the shoes,
no.
Hillary Kerr.
Come no, on. Juno Valentine and the magical shoes. So your book comes out.
My book comes out November 6th, and I cannot, like, begin to express what a fairy tale, like, dream come true this is.
We've been talking about it for a while.
I mean, you know, like, I am the biggest book nerd. Like,
huge. So why a children's book, and why Juno Valentine, and where did you come up with the idea, and tell me everything.
Okay, so I have always wanted to write children's books. I remember when I was a young girl, like, just a little bit older than Ren, I used to carry around one of those, like, black and white composition notebooks and write down ideas for books and pretend to write books. And even when I told my mom that I wrote this, she was like, this is like all you've ever wanted to do in life. I can't believe you are doing it. So I've had people ask me to write like grown-up books, like advice books, et cetera. And it's just like, I'm working on one. Woo, world exclusive. But like, but the children's book was just something like I wanted to write something for Ren and like her friends and that they would love. And I feel like fashion, you and I both know this, is like fashion is a way of like is a means of self-expression. Like you can wear a pair of cute, like coquettish, like red slingbacks. Are those Ghani? Where are those
they
from?
Are.
I love Ghani. Or like a pair of kind of like schoolgirl Gucci loafers, which I am now. And it changes how you feel about everything. And
it changes your outfit.
Yeah, it changes your outfit. It changes like the way you feel when you're walking down the street and the way you see the world. And for Ren, it's interesting because people assume that the book is about Ren. Like Ren doesn't care about fashion. She like is just beginning now to have an opinion on things. She's just as happy in like dinosaur leggings and like a sweatshirt than she is like twirling around in a tutu, which she just recently got into. And so it kind of explores the concept of like when you put on a different pair of shoes, like you can become different people and have a different opinion on the world. And I think that begins really young. I see now, like when I'm reading books that have like strong female characters, to my daughter who's she's almost four.
It's like she's a strong female character.
She's an extremely strong female character. I see her kind of taking these lessons in. And so I wanted to write a book about a little girl who tries on different pairs of shoes from historical characters like Frida Kahlo and Cleopatra to modern day icons like Serena Williams, and Anna Wintour does have a cameo in the book.
Is she wearing a Manolo?
She is, in fact, wearing a Manolo. There are a lot of Easter eggs in the books, and you guys can't see this because you're listening, but like even if you look at the cover, that's the Vivian Westwood heel that like Naomi Campbell famously tripped in. That's the Chanel slingback. That's the Manolo. I think it's called like Hangisi or something like that. The Sex and the City shoe. We'll just call it that. There are a lot of like little things hidden in this book. It was really a labor of love, and I'm really excited about it.
How did you go about figuring out the storyline? How long did it take to work on it? How did you partner with your illustrator? So, how much of the design comes from your brain versus a collaboration?
Yeah.
I don't understand how that part works.
The children's book process is really different and interesting. And I obviously had never been through it. I just had this idea of like, I grew up reading like the Narnia books, for instance. I am like a complete like Potterhead, like obsessed with Harry
Potter.
Really? You know I'm obsessed with like Harry Potter.
Oh, I didn't catch that at all. Like not from like knowing you or from this interview.
Like Danielle Nussbaum levels of Potter obsession, like Harry Potter. So like I had this idea of this like little girl that goes into her closet and goes through this like Narnia, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe experience of going to this crazy hall of shoes. So basically I had the idea, and then I started going to, I have an amazing book agent, Kate Hoyt, who has represented me for like, I think like 8 or 9 years from the beginning. She's been like, you have to write a book. She wanted me to write a grown-up book. And finally, after 9 years, I was like, Kate, I have this book idea. I'm doing it. I wrote half of it. And she got so excited. And then I was like, it's a children's book. She was like,
what?
She dropped to her knees. She was like, why won't you write this adult book? So she was like, okay, but we'll start with the children's book. So we started going to all these publishing houses. You've been through this. You go to these publishing houses, and there are these places that like, in my mind, it's like Harvard. Like, it's literally like, oh my God, like this is so crazy and storied. I can't believe I'm in the Random House offices. And they all have these like beautiful bookshelves, which they should. It's a publishing house. And so I started taking these Instagrams of literally like me hugging walls of books. And then I got this direct message from this woman that when I was at Lucky used to reach out to me, and she was at Macmillan, and she was like, are you just like hanging out children's publishing companies? Like, do you have a book that you're trying to publish? Like, why have you been to every house except for Macmillan? Like, WTF, basically. And I wrote back to her. I was like, hey, Allison, yeah, I'm publishing a children's book. Are you guys interested? I thought you guys rejected my manuscript. And then she was like, that is incorrect. You better get in here right now. And then the next day, I went and met this editor, Jean Fywell, who is like a legend in the children's publishing world. She did the Goosebumps books.
No.
She did Babysitters. She discovered the Babysitters Club.
Shut up.
Yeah.
That was everything.
Yeah. So she basically was the one who like discovered the writer and like kind of published all her books. And she brought Harry Potter to America. So
that was meant to be
done. And that's all she had to say. She was like, hey, and I'm like, done.
Great. Here. Okay. I'm home.
And she's cool. She has like tattoos. She's like has like a big like mastiff. She's like really badass. I immediately kind of like fell in love with her, and she got the vision of the book, and we cranked out the book in like 6 weeks. It was like insanely fast. I finished writing it like 1 week over Christmas. That week between Christmas and New Year's, I was in England, like visiting Tom's family. And like during the day, they would like sweep off the kids and take them to like petting farms and do all sorts of fun things with them in the English countryside. And I literally would like sit out and stare out into like rainy England. I felt very like
writerly.
Jane Austen. Yeah, it was like really like writerly. Exactly. Yeah. I wore glasses. I drank like a cup of tea. And then the illustrator I found also through Instagram, like it was, he tagged me in an illustration he had done and I started DMing him and then I saved one of his images in my collections on Instagram and I was like, oh, like this guy, Derek, would be so great if I ever write a children's book. And literally like a few weeks later, I was like, hey, Derek, have you ever done a children's book? And he said he always wanted to. And I was like, great. Okay. You have 3 weeks. Thanks. Bye. And so... It was a very collaborative process. We did basically everything over DM and FaceTime. He loves fashion, which is helpful. He was like nerding out and he was like, I don't know if you got this reference. This is a reference. There's one spread. I'm talking about it like it's a magazine, that there's this iconic shoot of Natalia Vodianova for Vogue where she was Alice in Wonderland.
Of course. It's only like the best one ever. Yeah. Annie Leibovitz shot it.
Exactly.
Right?
It had like all these fashion characters. So when he did this illustration of Juno falling through the kind of like crazy hall into the Hall of Shoes, like this makes me think of the Natalia Vodianova Vogue shoot. And he was like, that's literally what I based it on. And I was like, oh, my God, it's meant to be fashion synergy. And I showed Natalia this image when she came and visited me a few months ago. And she was like, this looks like. And I'm like, it is.
So tell me about the capsule collection that is coming out in conjunction with the book.
So it is a collection of 25 pieces I've never designed before. And oh my God, it is really fun.
So wait, where is it available?
So it's going to be at Janie and Jack. It hits stores November 5th. And so the outfit that Juno wears is like very hashtag iconic for her. It's like she wears that kind of like French bateau style, like stripy sailor shirt, then a pair of like kicky olive shorts and like these really basic white sneakers. And then she always has like a red bandana print scarf around her neck, which is one of like Ren's signatures because she like drools a little or went through a drooling, a very serious like river of drool phase. Not anymore. Oh my God, she's going to be so embarrassed if she's a teenager and listens to this one day. And so we literally created a collection inspired by her and some of the iconic women that are in the book. And it was like really fun and different to exercise that part of the brain where I was like, you know, in Japan, women wear headbands that, you know, are like little bunny ears. And I was like, oh, it would be so cute to do like a little bunny ear bandana print and a bandana print bomber and then like a holographic backpack. And like one of my favorite pieces from the collection are these like little clear kind of like iridescent pencil cases, which I've been using as makeup bags because it's really good to have a clear makeup bag because you can see what's in it. And so it's good for like security. And then there's so many favorite pieces in it, but there are these teeny, you know, those like the teeny tiny glasses trend that like Bella Hadid looks really good in and like pretty much human beings don't look good in it unless you're Bella Hadid.
Yes.
The other people that look good in those glasses are little human beings.
Children.
Yes, four-year-olds. So I created a teeny tiny like cat eye glasses, that sunglasses, that's part of the collection too. And it fits in the palm of your hand and it's really cute.
Okay, so last bits. We always like to end the podcast with some practical stuff.
Yes.
So what advice would you give women who are interested in changing lanes in their career, but maybe don't necessarily have the confidence to make the leap from print to social and digital or make the leap from law into something else? Mm-hmm. What advice would you give someone who's ready to take the leap but hasn't quite mustered up the courage?
I think the first thing you have to do is do all your research. I think that it's really easy to kind of romanticize a different industry, but then you really have to understand the mechanics of it. So a lot of the time I'll meet with people in these informational interviews who'll say like, oh, I'm a second year law associate. I know I want to do something creative and in fashion. And I'll be like, great. Like, I'm happy to help. Like, you think through this. Like, what do you want to do in fashion? Or, well, I don't know, something creative. And it's like,
well, what does that mean?
Exactly. You have to really narrow it down because the fashion industry, as you and I know, is like so multifaceted. You could be a designer, an editor, a stylist, like a set designer, a photographer. Like there's probably like just within the category of fashion, like 1,000 jobs within the world of fashion. So I think that if you know, you can distill down to the fact that you want to do something fashion and creative, but you really have to do more homework. Like if it's something as vague as that, you probably have like a year of doing research before you actually can do it. I also think that it's like a lot of people decide they want to do something, but then they don't. You have to have the courage to at least reach out and do informational interviews. So there's someone you admire or someone whose work that you admire. First, learn everything you can about them, but then like try to actually meet with them or someone like them and ask them about what they actually do. Because
the nuts and bolts of the day-to-day can be very different from what one imagines.
Exactly. Like if you look at my Instagram, it's like, yes, I do actually post Instagram stories about like just sitting around and doing email and trying to get down to inbox zero. But some people, like, you can't tell what they do on a day-to-day basis. I follow this like random vet on Instagram. He's posting a lot of animals he saved, but he's probably not posting like
the ones he didn't
or like the harder parts of the job. So it's like you have to kind of try to get a 360 of the job and tap every connection and kind of turn over every rock as you're looking for a new job. It's a competitive in like economy out there. And don't assume, a lot of people will say, well, like, well, I saved up like 8 weeks worth of expenses because I'm going to quit and look for a job. I'm like, you should assume that it will take you a year to find a new job, which is kind of maybe not the thing that everyone wants to hear from
this.
That's
practical.
But it's true. I talked to so many people who are like, I've been looking for a job for 8 weeks. I'm really discouraged. And I'm like,
You just started.
I know people who are looking for jobs for 8 months. It's like, and that's why it's really important to be practical with your money, have a savings account. And if you're thinking about going freelance, you need like 3 to 6 months of living expenses too, because people take a long time to pay you.
That is a fact. I learned that one the hard way and got myself into some credit card debt doing that.
There
so if you could go back in time, take a little time machine, go visit younger Eva. What advice would you give yourself?
I don't know, because I probably wouldn't change anything per se, but I would just say like everything happens for a reason, and just keep learning and keep your eyes open and follow your passion, because that's always been, I think, the guiding principle of my career. I think a lot of people have asked me in recent years, like, oh, you made the switch from print to digital. How did you know X, Y, and Z? And it's like, I didn't. I had no idea. I always literally, like, every decision I've made in my career, it might not have made sense for me at the time to, like, leave Teen Vogue when I had a great big job that I loved. But I just kind of followed my instinct and followed things that, like, I would find interesting. I would just say, like, just keep following those signs. Like, the signs in the universe are there. Like, for me, switching from pre-med to wanting to work in magazines, the signs were actually there when I was 15 or 16 years old. I grew up surrounded by fashion magazines my mom subscribed to, watching my mom dress up and, like, just, like, watching my mom, like, put on red lipstick. Like, I grew up loving these things, but I was never able to articulate that, like, that was a clue that I was interested in those things, you know? The signs are there. I really
do. Whether or not you're listening to them.
Exactly.
Oh, last question.
Yes.
What are you buying for fall and why?
What am I buying for fall
and why? What's one thing that you love for fall?
I'm really into pearls right now. Which
I can sounds, tell.
Yeah, I'm like draped in pearls right now. So I'm really into like freshwater pearls.
Okay. Well, thank you, Eva, so much. I know you just got back from Fashion Week. You got to go.
I got to go.
That was the Director of Fashion Partnerships at Instagram, Eva Chen. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social. And now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Twitter and Instagram. We even have a Facebook page, Just Saying. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send in your request to hello@secondlifepod.com if you're into email, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.